weapons. Padded pugil sticks, throwing knives, paintball guns for non-lethal close combat drills, training body armor, various kinds of rubber and wooden weapons, and handheld targets. About 30 men and women were training in pairs, some under an instructor's eye, others, more advanced teams, working out on their own. Top and Bunny followed Saxon between the groups in what was clearly an attempt to impress them. And they were impressed. These were not raw boot camp greenhorns. They were seasoned fighters who knew their trade. Very fast, very dangerous. They stopped by one square where a fight was ending. The loser was on his hands and knees, goggle-eyed and purple-faced, crawling like a geriatric, away from a man who was 5.5 feet tall and about 4 wide, with no visible neck, a bull chest, pig eyes, and a blend of Navy and prison tattoos. He also had a stylized 88 over his heart.
"Sergeant Wilkes," said Saxon, "meet the candidates. Big one is Buck, older one is Gidry."
Wilkes ignored Bunny and looked Top up and down. His expression was one of abject disregard. To Saxon, he said,
"Old Black Joe here looks like he's past his sell-by date."
Top said nothing, showed nothing. Bunny couldn't help but laugh. Wilkes gave him a sharp look.
"You got something to say?"
"Fuck you," comes to mind, said Bunny. That caused a murmur of comments and snickers from the watching crowd. Wilkes pointed a calloused finger at him.
"You're officially on my list. Don't give a cold, dried shit."
That made the sergeant grin with ghoulish delight. He clapped Saxon on the shoulder.
"I'm calling dibs on these two assholes."
Bunny turned to Saxon.
"This how you run your recruitment program? Must have missed that in the sales pitch."
Saxon looked momentarily uncertain, then shrugged.
"They're not signed on yet," he said to Wilkes. "But yeah, run them a bit, see how they shake out. It'll tell me how much work we have to do to get them back in the game. Just don't mess them up too much."
"Yeah, yeah, I'm officially shitting my pants," said Bunny, punctuating it with a yawn.
"Oh, hell," said Wilkes with real delight. "I'm going to saw a good yard off this big cocksucker."
Bunny was 6'6" and was easily the tallest man in the gym.
"Let's do it, old hoss. Let's rock and roll."
"No," said Top, and everyone looked at him. "I've got some things I'd like to discuss with the sergeant here. You step off, farm boy. Let the grown-ups have a chit-chat."
Wilkes burst out laughing.
"You want to go a few rounds with me? That's awesome."
"No," said Top. "Just the one round will do."
That got an even bigger laugh, and Wilkes grinned so hard it looked like his gristly ears would fall off. He cut a look at Saxon.
"Arrogant and stupid. You sure know how to find him. What's the other one, an autistic faggot?"
Bunny merely smiled and went over to lean against the wall, arms folded across his chest, watching as Top removed his wristwatch, hat, and shirt and placed them neatly on a corner of the mat. Beneath the shirt, he had a faded green, brown, and black camouflage tank top. His dark skin was crisscrossed with scars, old and new, and although he was muscular, he was not a muscle freak like Wilkes, or like Bunny for that matter. He was built more like a first baseman, solid, the kind who could block a runner sliding into base. However, his age was apparent in the white salted through his black goatee and in the lines around his eyes and mouth. People were joining the crowd from the other training areas, drawn by loud voices and laughter. They looked from Wilkes to Top and elbowed each other, laughing, making bets on how fast the sergeant was going to dismantle the old guy. Wilkes made a big show of waving Top onto the padded training area, even to the point of giving a small comical bow like a ringleader at a dog circus. He never stopped grinning. When he stepped onto the mat, he looked Top in the eye and tapped the 88 tattoo. The 8th letter of the alphabet was H, and 88 was shorthand for Heil Hitler. There was a burning cross on the sergeant's stomach. Top did not take up a stance or even bring his guard up. His only concession to the level of threat was to shift his weight subtly to the balls of his feet. He waited for the brute of a sergeant to make his play. When it all happened fast. Wilkes faked left and then stepped in very fast with an overhand right that was a rock breaker, a bone crusher, a lethal blow. His whole body went into the punch. Good stance, the right kind of pivot to torque energy into his monstrous shoulders so that the punch was a blurred, whipping loop of gristle and bone. A younger, faster man would have had trouble slipping or evading that punch, and it was very obvious this was Sergeant Wilkes's deal closer, the blow he used when he wanted to prove a point to everyone within visual range, the kind of punch that would be talked about among the fixers for years. Top did not evade, did not duck, bob, or weave. He stepped right into the attack, shifting only a little to the right as he brought his elbow up into the path of the muscular arm, the flats of his curled fingers pressed against his skull, and he used his step to drive a single punch into the narrow gap between one, eight, and the other. Every ounce of Top's 200 pounds, 40 years of karate, and career as a Tier 1 special operator went into it. This was his deal closer. A tighter, smarter, less obvious punch that channeled all his muscle, mass, and momentum into an impact point no larger than a dime. The sergeant's entire body folded around the punch. The blow knocked spit from his mouth, drove all the air from his lungs, took all the rigidity from his muscles, turned his legs to overcooked pasta, and sat him down hard on his ass in front of everyone. His eyes bulged and his face turned an eggplant purple as he tried to suck in even a spoonful of air. Top knotted his fingers in Wilkes's short hair, jerked his head back so violently there was a wet creaking sound, and then he spat in the sergeant's gasping mouth. Top straightened, started to turn, paused, and shot a back heel kick into the man's right eye socket. Wilkes flopped back, arms and legs splayed like a starfish. The right side of his face no longer held its shape. Blood leaked from nostrils, ears, and mouth. The room was utterly silent. Top went over and retrieved his shirt and stood buttoning it very slowly. His eyes were locked on Saxon's. Bunny came and stood next to Top, but facing away, watching the crowd.
"We didn't come here to fuck around," said Top quietly. "I thought we were here to audition for a job."
Saxon looked aghast at first. Then a slow smile blossomed on his face. Chapter 48. Phoenix House, headquarters of Rogue Team International, Amphori Island, Greece. Mr. Church moved through the rooms of his big apartment on the top floor of the ancient castle he'd purchased and had brought stone by stone to the island. The gigantic building had once belonged to Francis II Rákóczi, a Hungarian nobleman from the early 18th century who had been a prince of Transylvania and a celebrated member of the Order of the Golden Fleece. As was his habit when deeply troubled, Church lingered in his study, which was lined with bookshelves, on which were volumes in scores of languages, books both new and ancient. There was a rack of scrolls and a row of small and exquisite busts in a case. Church opened the case and looked into the marble faces of Prince Charles of Hesse Kassel, Gian Gastone de' Medici, last of the Medicis, the Marquis de Crequy, the composer Jean-Philippe Rameau, the occultist Giuseppe Balsamo, who preferred to be called Count Alessandro di Cagliostro, the Italian adventurer Giacomo Casanova, the Duke de Belle Isle, and the theosophist Madame Blavatsky. Other faces watched him from canvases carefully framed and hung so that they leaned slightly forward from the walls, as if bending to participate in hushed conversations. Speakers of superb fidelity in the other room played an aria, Opus 36-32, Povero Corperce Palpito, in G major, sung by a Japanese soprano whose voice called to mind an angel wreathed in light. It was a necessary change from the improvisational jazz he'd listened to while making all those calls. Church's cat, a Scottish fold with fur the color of wood smoke, watched him from his favorite niche between a high-quality bound photocopy of Inventio Fortunata, written by a 14th-century monk whose name was lost to time, and a pair of George II flintlock brass-barreled militia officers' dueling pistols made by George E. Jones in 1803, with an inscription carefully scrolled onto the brass butt plate of the right-hand gun. The inscription read, "Post tenebras spero lucem," after darkness, I hope for light, though the inscriber was not referring to the old Calvinist catchphrase. That phrase had very special meaning for Church, and was also chiseled into the first foundation stone when the castle was erected here on this small Greek island. A discreet bell rang in the foyer, and he walked out to look at the screen mounted beside the door. A young and very muscular man stood there, face lifted to the security camera. His name was Luke Merishi, and he was a Muran, a Maasai warrior from Kenya, and a former member of the Lion Guardians. Luke's grandfather had been a close friend of Mr. Church, and together they'd torn down a huge poaching ring. Luke was one of Church's private guards, but was also in training for possible inclusion in an RTI field team. He wore a standard gray patrol uniform, but with a red and black checked Maasai sash, ornate multicolored arm bracelets, necklace, and earrings. A pistol was holstered in a nylon shoulder rig, but he carried a 20-inch rungu, the deadly throwing club made of polished ebony wood, in one strong hand. Church pressed a button. "Yes, Luke, what is it?" The young warrior stepped aside to reveal a second man standing behind him. This man, though still in his 30s, was 10 years older than the Maasai. He wore distressed jeans and a dove gray t-shirt with a French tuck.
"Mr. Chisma is requesting a meeting," said Luke. "He insists it's urgent. Mr. Wilson sent him up."
"Very well," said Church, and opened the door.
"My apologies, sir," began Luke, but Church waved it away.
"You were quite correct to bring him up here, Luke," said Church. "Thank you." The young Maasai frowned and turned to toys.
"Don't make me regret doing this."
"Cheers, mate," said toys. Then he turned to Church. "We need to talk."
"So it seems. Come in." He stepped aside and allowed toys to come inside. Guests in this part of the castle were exceptionally rare, and normally Church would never have allowed toys up here. However, Church was intrigued by the young man's urgency. He nodded to Luke and closed the door, then ushered toys into the study, waving him to one of the big leather chairs positioned before a modest fire. Toys refused a glass of wine and instead flung himself into the chair and spent a few moments staring at the books and art. Toys frowned and nodded to a manuscript of a play left open inside a plexiglass case.
"The History of Cardenio," he mused. "Really? I thought that was one of Shakespeare's lost plays. So what's this, a recreation? A novelty? Or did someone sell you a high-end phony?"
Church sat back in his chair, crossed his legs, and brushed a tiny piece of lint from his trouser leg. "What can I do for you, Mr. Chismer?" Toys kept looking around for a few more moments, making occasional grunts. Then he sighed and looked at Church.
"Did Junie Flynn tell you about her premonition the night Ledger went missing?"
"She did. She also discussed it with Dr. Sanchez."
"Did she tell you she passed out when she had it?" "We were at Freetek celebrating the completion of the water purification system we set up in Botswana, and she dropped her glass and went tits up. I thought she'd had a bloody heart attack, but it was that vision of Joe Ledger being in some kind of trouble. And she hasn't been the same since. And it'll be a month tomorrow."
Church said nothing.
"I know she's been calling you around the effing clock, and all Scott Wilson will tell her is that Ledger is on a mission and unavailable, but I know for a fact that Top and Bunny are in the States working on something else, and that Belle and Andrea are off working on something in the UK, all of which suggests the on a mission thing is tosh.
Church did not ask how Toys knew all this. The young man was notoriously resourceful.
Given what happened on Christmas Eve, continued Toys, my guess is that Ledger has gone round the twist. Something dodgy like that. Maybe you have him locked up somewhere for his own good, and if so, then all's right in the world and I can go back home. I can even try to sell Junie a story that'll let her get some sleep at night. But I don't think that's it, is it? I think something's happened to Ledger, and on some level, somehow, Junie knows it, feels it, whatever.
Is there a point to all this? Asked Church. Toys leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees.
I think we both know that I don't give a leper's missing left nut about Ledger, and I'm hardly his favorite bloke, but I care a lot about Junie.
Fair to say there's no one I care about as much. She is the best human being I've ever met, and she treats me, a total piece of shit like me, like I'm a person. She has from the jump, even though she knows my past. She knows the things I've done, and she doesn't care about it. She judges me on who I am now, which is something I don't even bloody well know how to process. Are you following me?
Get to your point, said Church.
My point is that if Ledger is in trouble, then I want to help.
Church folded his hands in his lap.
There are a lot of people already positioned to help Colonel Ledger.
Sure, said Toys.
And so what? Why would I even consider putting you into the field?
For the same effing reason you pick up the phone every time you need a throat cut,
snapped Toys.
You keep doing it, too. When you're resource poor, you make a call and I come running. Want to or not, I bloody well take that call because I have a debt outstanding with you we both know I can't ever repay.
You are doing the work that best suits you.
With free tech? Give me a sorting break. A trained monkey could do what I do. I write checks that allow Junie and her people to do the real work. I sort out logistics, rent offices, and all of that shite. But it's a misuse of who I am, and we both know it.
And who are you, Mr. Chismer? Asked Church. In your eyes, who are you?
Toys looked into Church's eyes, deeply enough that the ambient temperature of the room seemed to drop.
I'm a killer, said Toys, and I'm very damned good at it.
Church pursed his lips for a moment.
You are?
Know what else I'm good at? Know why Sebastian Galt, the Seven Kings, and Hugo Vox all knew about me? I can find things. I may be out of the game, but my connections are still out there. I used to be wired in everywhere. You have your cronies, Lilith and her arc-light witches, friends in the industry, that lot, but my connections are likely off your radar. Or maybe below your radar. Look, I know that you're hunting Cougar. I know that Cougar took over most of O'Han's black market network after Lilith cut his throat. That's fine. But I'll bet Cougar allowed or encouraged a lot of the key players in O'Han's network to come over to his team. Why? Because that's a smart way to run a business like that. I have connections on the dark web left over from my time with Galt and Vox. Just because I stepped away from that life doesn't mean I can't work the game if I really wanted to.
And you would step back into that world for Joe Ledger.
Now, weren't you listening? Said Toys, shaking his head slowly. It's not for Ledger, I told you. This is for Junie Flynn.
Church pursed his lips.
Do you think this is your path to redemption, Mr. Chismer?
No, said Toys flatly. We both know that I'm past any chance of redemption, so this isn't about me. Not sure why you can't see that. This is all about Junie. She's worth 100 of Ledger. She's better and cleaner than either of us.
I won't argue that, said Church.
I want you to put me into play. Put me back in the game and let me help her by doing what I can for the man she, beyond all common effing sense, loves.
There is every chance many of your old contacts will never believe you've changed sides.
So what? Seriously, Church, there is no honor among thieves. It's all about business, about money. I can make deals that will make people money, and that will erase all past sins.
You might find that some people are less forgiving. There are likely old allies of the Seven Kings who might want to nail your hide to the wall.
Toys gave him a smile that was very much like one of the more poisonous jungle snakes.
Let them try.
Church was silent for a long time. The aria that had been playing ended, and another began, a moody violin piece, an adagio in E flat major.
If you do this, he said at length, there may be no turning back. You escaped this war once. You may not be able to do so again.
Another risks. Put me in play.
Church stood up.
Very well. If you want to risk whatever measure of peace you've achieved, then welcome to the war, Mr. Chismer.
The young man stood up too. His dour face underwent a slow process of change. The lugubrious mask of grief he'd worn for years seemed to fall away, to be replaced by the smallest of smiles, a cold, sly, unpleasant smile.
Stop calling me that, he said. My name is Toys.
Chapter 49 Blue Diamond Training Camp, Caddo Mills, Texas.
These are the two men I told you about, said John Saxon.
They were in a classroom that had been repurposed as an executive office. Top and Bunny stood flanking Saxon, all of them facing a woman behind a big oak desk. Everything in the office was high-end, from the imported Turkish carpets to the display case of bronze sculptures. A brass plate on a block of lignum vitae read, Jill Hamilton Krajcik. She was a short brunette with a pretty and intelligent face. Her expression had the kind of apparent brightness of spirit that Top thought looked more like an executive in the music or film business. She did not look like the kind of person to be overseeing a training camp for private military contractors. She wore a pendant with an exquisite marquee-cut blue diamond that had to be 3 carats and was a rich and radiant azure. Small half-carat matching diamonds dangled from her earlobe. Top, who'd once researched that kind of stone when Blue Diamond first came on the DMS radar, estimated that the total value of those gems was north of $1 million. She gave them a radiant smile and waved Top and Bunny toward a pair of leather chairs that were soft as butter. Top noted that the chairs were set too low, so that the desk was slightly higher than normal, creating a subjective view of the executive being taller and more physically imposing than anyone who came to meet with her. A nice trick. It wasn't all that different from the trick Colonel Ledger often used, slouching slightly to make himself look shorter, smaller, and slower than he actually was, right before he went apeshit over someone. Saxon introduced the two recruits.
Anything else I can do for you, HK?
Thanks, John,
said the woman to Saxon. There was a quality of dismissal in her tone, and Saxon nodded and left. When they were alone, HK spent a few moments studying the two men, and they sat in silence, allowing it.
Mr. Guidry and Mr. Redfield, she said. It's a pleasure to meet you. Please call me HK.
Meet you, said Bunny. You here to give us some shit about what happened last week? Asked Top.
HK raised her eyebrows.
What? With Sergeant Wilkes? Ha! No. He was a racist, sexist, homophobic piece of shit. And from what John Saxon said in his report, you were within your rights.
Don't sugarcoat it, said Bunny.
She gave them both a sunny smile.
He patted me on the ass once. I was planning on having him kneecapped anyway.
Top made a soft grunting noise and folded his arms.
Saxon set us up, said Bunny.
Well, that's his job, isn't it?
She countered. Then she sat back and laced her fingers together on top of the desk.
Look, guys, this isn't the Cub Scouts. You know what Blue Diamond does, or you wouldn't be here. One of our field scouts pegged you as likely material, and we did a thorough background check on each of you, all the way back to kindergarten. You, Mr. Redfield.
Call me Buck.
You, Buck, are a bit of a bad boy type.
she continued.
Maybe playing to type? Milking the reputation?
Bunny said nothing.
And you, Mr. Guidry, said H.K., you make a big show of liking to sit racist pricks down on their ass, but I wonder if what you really like is the fight itself.
You walking anywhere in the direction of a point? Asked Top.
Right to it, then. Sure, that's fine, said H.K. Over the last 8 days, you've been tested on a lot of different weapons systems, military tactics, and threat assessment capabilities, and you each demonstrated a remarkably wide range of knowledge and comfort.
If it goes bang or boom, we know about it, said Bunny.
And your unarmed combat skills are several cuts above the norm, on a par with Delta. Which makes me wonder why neither of you were ever recruited by them.
I think you know the answer to that, Top said quietly.
Because you don't play well with others except when you want to, said H.K., and because neither of you is averse to making some unreported money on the side.
Times are tough, said Bunny. Economy's in the toilet.
Oh, I'm not judging, H.K. said brightly. I'm very much in favor of an entrepreneurial spirit. We are, to be more precise.
We being Blue Diamond? Asked Top.
Her smile changed, became smaller, and a bit secretive.
Consider Blue Diamond, at least this division of it, as a talent agency for very specialized services we offer to a variety of clients.
They said nothing, waiting for the other shoe.
It's clear that you two are a cut above the usual herd, continued H.K. Your aptitude, resourcefulness, and knowledge are top shelf, and quite frankly, you're overqualified for the kind of work most of Blue Diamond does.
Not much I won't do for a paycheck and Benny's, said Bunny. Most employers stop reading when they get to the details of my discharge.
We are not most employers, she said, again flashing that thousand-watt smile. We are a concierge service that provides top talent to customers who need the very best. And I do mean the best. That is not sales hype, gentlemen. It's a point of fact. To keep you here at this facility would be a waste of your time and ours.
Wait, are you firing us? Asked Bunny.
Just the opposite. I want to transfer you boys to a different training camp, a place where we work with upper-tier operators like yourselves.
There's some kind of scam? Asked Top.
No, she said. It's really not. In fact, I'd like to put you both on a plane this afternoon.
To where? Asked Top. To meet who? Asked Bunny.
Where isn't important. You both have passports? Good. You may need them. As for who? Well, let's just say it's someone very special.
Chapter 50. In Flight Over the Ionian Sea. Toys sat on a leather bench seat behind an oak table as the private jet punched through the skies toward Italy. He had a mind reader Q1 laptop open and was sipping a very good Bloody Mary while reviewing data that Church told him was eyes only.
You'll have access to the information Bug has been compiling, Church had told him before the flight. We have people in the field already looking for Ledger. Violin is out there, along with others from Arclight. And a few of my old friends are keeping their eyes and ears open. Their reports are in the material I'm sharing with you.
Have to say,
Toys had told him while they were on the tarmac behind Phoenix House.
I'm surprised you agreed to letting me do this.
Church had studied him for a long three count before saying,
You've had plenty of opportunities to betray my trust. You haven't. You've had opportunities to refuse some of the wet work jobs I've sent your way. You did not.
What's that make me, a well-trained spaniel?
No, said Church, offering his hand. It means that you're part of the family.
They shook hands, and Toys had turned away quickly, nearly running to the plane, because he absolutely did not want Church to see his expression, to see the shock, to see the tears. Now he was on his way. Toys was impressed by how much data had been collected, and he was already seeing some patterns emerge. And it was a rather ugly pattern. Ledger was moving like a plague through the technologies and weapons black markets, not counting the slaughter in Croatia, Bug estimated that the body count was somewhere around 40.
"Well, mate," he said to the photo of Joe Ledger on his screen, "you're throwing a wobbly and no mistake, bloody hell."
He finished his drink and hit the bell to call the cabin steward to make another. The steward was a slender young chap with the most beautiful eyes. Toys was the only passenger aboard the jet and liked seeing the way the steward moved, like a dancer, very tasty. But, alas, there was no time for recreation. It was a short flight, and once he was on the ground, there would be no time for anything but work. He gave the lad his very best smile as he accepted the new Bloody Mary, then forced himself to go back to the screen, to the horrors, and to doors Toys was very sure he could open if he applied just the right leverage. Chapter 51. Chambly-Bussière Air Base near Metz, France, 4 weeks ago. There are few jobs as deeply tedious as patrol shifts on a military base. Marcel Chauffeur was convinced of that. He'd thought it through over many a long night as he paced along the geometry of his prescribed route. Sometimes he was with another airman, often the lout Anton, who seldom used two words when one would serve, and who smelled of bean farts and cigarettes. Marcel preferred his particular friend, Gerard, who was chatty and funny and actually read, which allowed the two mates to have long, involved conversations about politics. They were both centrists, Marcel leaning left and Gerard tilting right, and books. Gerard preferred contemporary crime writers like Antonin Varennes and Pierre Lemaitre, while Marcel liked the 19th-century horror authors such as Petrus Borel, Théophile Gautier, and Guy de Maupassant. They liked the same music, mid-20th-century American jazz, but could never agree on poetry, which allowed for some truly satisfying arguments. Tonight, though, Marcel was walking alone, patrolling in the new captain's staggered pattern. That meant the sentries were spaced out so that while there was always someone in line of sight, fewer men could walk a larger grid. More cost-cutting, which meant hours trapped in his own thoughts. Well-formed opinions are a burden when there is no one to share them with. The base was a large one and had once been used by the United States Air Force and as a frontline installation during the Cold War. But the Soviets had never tried to march into France, and the Americans left in 1967, the year Marcel's father was born. Since then, it had been the sole property of the Armée de l'Air, and more recently, much of the base had been redeveloped as a commercial business park. Military staff were reduced constantly, though the place was still technically a military airfield. Sort of. The most exciting thing that happened on the base was the Lorraine Mondiale Air Balance, Europe's grandest hot air balloon festival. That was only every other year, though, and this wasn't the year. And so Marcel Chauffeur was profoundly bored. What would have been nice would be a transfer to the other team, to the mixed group of airmen and soldiers working underground, 100 meters below the groundskeeper's barn and under part of Biomedical Research Center, was the lab, a very secret lab that had no official name and did not, according to the detailed maps of the airbase, exist at all. One of those oh-so-clever hide-in-plain-sight facilities in which the government does all sorts of unspeakable stuff. This one, a close friend had confided in him 5 pints into a Friday night, had been built by the Agence de l'Innovation de Défense, France's answer to the American DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The people who invented things like the bloody Internet, Siri, and GPS. He knew that the French, being much smarter than the Yanks, must be doing something on the level of Star Trek. Not the original series, but something like Discovery or Picard. Sleek and sophisticated, where function is in harmony with form. That thought pleased him, because it was proof the 3 semesters at university were not, as his father so often said, wasted. But he wasn't on that detail. A place like that was not patrolled by regular airmen like he was. He was not supposed to even be aware of it, and the fact that he did was probably a capital crime. Even so, it must be interesting to work there, he thought, just to stroll around and look here or there or in there. It would be so great. But it was such a long evening that he actually prayed for an interruption. A truck delivery, perhaps. That would be nice, because verifying papers and inspecting cargo could nicely chew up half an hour. More if it was a small convoy bringing supplies in for one of the commercial properties. And there was a redhead who drove one of those trucks, and Marcel was sure he could get her number or email address given another opportunity. He was on his third circuit, and wondering if he could get leave to go take a piss. The third cup of coffee was probably a poor decision before patrol, when he saw headlights bumping over the road. Yes, he said aloud. He headed over to the gate, which was part of his patrol zone, and stood close to the corporal working the booth. Paul was not a friend, but friendly enough. One of those older fellows who joined the military after a failed marriage, with the simple plan of letting someone else run his life henceforth. A bit dull, but always up on the latest football scores. "What's coming in?" asked Marcel as he leaned on the rail by the open booth door. The corporal frowned down at a clipboard.
Says here decorative foliage.
For whom?
I think for the little common area they're building goes in the barn.
Odd, said Marcel.
They've not even finished the hardscaping on that. Isn't it too soon for plants?
The hell should I know? Groused Paul. I grew up in Paris. I don't think I ever saw a tree or shrub until I enlisted.
He stepped past Marcel and made that hand-patting gesture that told the driver to slow down and stop. The lorry was a big one, and Marcel wondered how many damned shrubs they had ordered. Or did someone screw up and send a big lorry like this instead of a more appropriately sized van? The driver was a very pretty woman, and Marcel perked up. She was petite, blonde, very nice to look at. A bit like that actress from the comic book movie, the one with the baseball bat and too much lipstick. Marcel could not fish her name out of his head. His knowledge of American cinema was only marginally better than what he knew about British film. He was okay with the Italians, but mostly the retro stuff. This driver, though, could have fit into the old 60s and 70s giallo films, or maybe a young Catherine Deneuve, but with a punk finish. Marcel watched the woman hand an ID card to Paul, give only a slight up-tilt of her nose at Paul's leering smile, pop chewing gum very loudly, take her card back, and drive in through the gate. Marcel smoked a cigarette with Paul, then continued his patrol. He kept thinking of the driver mostly because he could not remember the name of the actress who played in that superhero movie. The sentries were not allowed to use their cell phones on patrol, so he couldn't do a search, and eventually he forgot about the actress, the driver, and the truck. His memory was triggered when the truck drove out 94 minutes later, and then it vanished again. What really made every detail of that woman and that truck was when all the lights on the base flashed on, a dozen sirens blared, and military police swarmed through in riot gear. For the next 3 days, Marcel, along with Paul and everyone on patrol or guard duty that night, sat in rooms while teams of investigators screamed questions at him. They did not actually explain things outright, but over time, by piecing together bits of different questions, he worked it out. The truck drove in using a false ID. It parked behind the biomedical research center. A gate was lowered and 2 forklifts were offloaded, and later found abandoned, and then used to remove tons of vital and highly classified machines, computer mainframes, and other unspecified materials. Interlude 11. Sales presentation via showroom 2 months ago. Mr. Sunday had a somewhat larger group of buyers online today, so many that he had his team bring in 2 mobile racks of monitors so that he was able to give a sales pitch to faces on 84 screens. The key was to make sure none of them could see the others, and all mics were muted. It was a rare day when there were no women among the potential clients. He found that disappointing. He was an equal opportunity vendor.
"Gentlemen, so delighted that you could join us, and so many. You can't see all the smiling faces, but I can. Well, maybe not smiling yet, but I can guarantee that I'll have you all grinning by the time I'm done."
A few of the faces were smiling. Most were a mix of first-time buyers who were either scowling, frowning in uncertainty, or wearing their best poker faces. Sunday was not fooled. He could read their eyes, and none of them would have accepted his invitation had it not been for the teasers in the auto-deleted sales prospectus he'd sent along with the invitation. That had been a fun piece of work, and Sunday used a top music video editor to make the blink-or-you-miss-it peeks at the exosuits and other goodies that were fast and sexy. He wondered what most of these men would say if they knew that film editor was black. Sunday loved his little jokes. Not that every face on the screens was white. There were black and brown faces, too. Not as many. But they were every bit as radicalized, every bit as committed to their causes. When viewed from any objective distance, all these men were cut from the same essential cloth. Us, not them. Our way, not anyone else's. Zealotry was Sunday's oldest friend.
"I'm here to offer you a chance to get in on the ground floor of what will, without any chance of a doubt, be the biggest damned thing that's ever happened in the U.S. of A. Something that will change the political landscape and return power to the people, to your people. Now, my fellow patriots," he said, "let's talk about how to take back America."
Chapter 52. Blue Diamond Training Camp, Caddo Mills, Texas. The window in HK's office looked out on green trees standing like a wall around a training area. Men and women wearing full gear and backpacks filled with rocks jogged by. Some puffed and sweated and lagged, but most moved with the oiled efficiency of machines. Even among those, there were a handful who seemed to be untouched by the exertion of a 10-mile run with over 100 pounds of weight and over uneven and treacherous terrain. Each of the fittest and most elite of the fixers, and the men all wore beards, though some were still new and scraggly. Growing beards was required for this operation, and the length and cut would be determined later. Nearly all of them had tattoos of various kinds, military, patriotic, some prison ink, and a lot of symbology ranging from a dozen variations of "Don't Tread on Me" to KKK images, Nazi Party images and codes, and flags tied to different political ideologies. Some of the skin art had been in place long before the recruiters like John Saxon scouted them, but a lot was new. It made for a strange mix, because a white man with a Klan tattoo of a burning cross jogged next to a black man with an Antifa symbol. They joked as they ran. In one of the tents, a group of tattoo artists were at work, day and night. They ran past the repurposed middle school directly beneath HK's window and then along a series of trails that took them outside the compound and through the woods. They passed under thousands of pine trees. But as alert and trained as they all were, and as sharp as the drill sergeants were, not one of them saw the shrouded figure high in the boughs. None of them felt the invisible crosshairs touching them over the hearts or between the shoulder blades. The group ran past a crumbling old shack that had been abandoned by a failed logging company 30 years ago. A row of birds stood on the eaves, their heads turning as the men and women went by. None of the soldiers peeled off to check the shack, and even if they had, they would have needed to lift a section of rotted floor to find where Andrea crouched, covered in a tarp, head bowed over a mind reader screen on which the video feeds from two of the birds played out. Each time a face came into focus, Andrea took a screenshot and fed it to the facial recognition software. The fixers ran on. Belle and Andrea might not have even existed for all they were aware of them. Chapter 53. Freetech Research and Development Office, San Diego, California.
This feels weird.
Junie Flynn sat on a park bench with Rudy Sanchez. Birds by the hundred chattered in the trees. Sunlight filtered through the canopy of softly shifting leaves, dappling everything with lemon drops. Across from the bench was a big field where crews were inflating gorgeously colored hot air balloons. A dozen were already lifting off the ground, their colors almost glowing against a flawless canvas of blue sky.
I agree, said Rudy. Would you like a different background? Here, let me see if I can change it.
I don't want anything, Rudy, said Junie. Just us talking is fine.
The park, the trees, the birds, the sunlight, and the blue sky shimmered and then winked out. Junie was immediately back in her office at Freetech. Rudy was still there, sitting now on a chair that seemed to fade out at the edges so that it had no legs and an incomplete back. He shimmered too, but otherwise remained.
Orb technology, he said with a disdainful sniff. Everyone else seems to love it, but I guess I'm like you. It disturbs my sense of order.
Rudy, said Junie, diving right in, I've called Mr. Church I don't know how many times, and I always get the same answer. Colonel Ledger is on an extended field op and has gone dark for security reasons or some variation on that.
Yes, I know,
said Rudy with a sigh.
And now Toys is gone.
Gone?
He said he wanted to look into something, and then poof, he vanishes from the face of the earth. I tried to get in touch with Top and Bunny, but apparently they're on an operation too. God, Rudy, you have to give me something. Like, since you're there, can you talk to Church? I thought I was in the inner circle, but he, Scott Wilson, and the others have closed me out. It's not right, and it's not fair. I don't need to know every detail, but at least someone should be able to tell me if Joe is all right.
Junie paused and looked into Rudy's eyes.
Can you tell me something?
Rudy looked uncomfortable, even pained.
I can tell you some things I discussed with Church before I set up this call, and quite frankly, I read him the riot act for closing you out like this. Church, as you know, is a man more concerned with fighting the war than dealing with the human emotions of the people on the field, and more to your point, on the sidelines.
Junie leaned forward, her fists knotted together in her lap.
Rudy, is Joe alive?
Yes, said Rudy, managing what looked like a careful smile. He is alive.
Junie closed her eyes for a long moment, taking very slow and very deep breaths.
Is he hurt?
She asked, looking once more at him.
Is that what this is? Is Joe in some hospital somewhere with half his face torn off or a bullet in him? What is it this time? I can tell something's wrong.
As far as I know, he is not injured. Not physically.
What's that supposed to mean?
Then she paused. Two vertical lines appeared between her brows.
This is about Christmas Eve, isn't it?
Yes, I'm afraid it is.
What is it, though? Some kind of PTSD because of what happened?
PTSD is the very least of it, said Rudy, his rich baritone voice filled with cracks. Listen to me, Junie. You know that Joe is who he is because of trauma. The horrors inflicted on him and his girlfriend Helen when they were 14 destroyed much of the person he'd been before that. You know that this trauma created fractures in his psyche that resulted in the emergences of a number of limited dimension shadow personalities. Many of them at first, and since he and I began our therapy, that number was reduced to 3.
Yes, the modern man, the cop, and the warrior.
Correct. The modern man is the closest to who Joe might have become had his life not been so profoundly overshadowed by what happened at age 14 and then again later when he found Helen after her suicide.
Junie nodded. She knew that the suicide had also done considerable damage to Rudy because Helen was the first of his patients to take her own life.
The cop, Shadow Self, is the one that gives him the balance, the pragmatism that allows him to function in day-to-day life, but that collects and refines his acquired skills in ways that made him an excellent police officer and later detective. He tries to be the cop every minute of every day of his professional life. You've seen that aspect of him, but I suspect you are most in love with the affable, somewhat goofy modern man. That lover of rare steaks, craft beer, Hawaiian shirts, and baseball.
Junie smiled despite the stress, and she nodded, then added, But I love all of him.
Is that really true, though? You mentioned his third shadow self, the killer, but you used the older nickname Joe had for that aspect when you called him the warrior. In truth, I believe the warrior part of him was really an extension of the cop self, in the same way that a pragmatic policeman who tries to prevent or investigate crimes might be required to draw his weapon and even take a life. The cop is the true warrior, a person who studies the art and science of warfare and is sophisticated in his understanding of the often ugly things such a person is forced to do, in defense of those incapable of their own protection. However, since joining the old Department of Military Sciences, his third shadow self has had cause to become far more aggressive than before, less a warrior and more of a primal savage, not mindless or heartless, rather the reverse, possessed of a deep and unshakable need to protect the weaker members of the tribe. In that defense, there is no limit to what the killer would do. I have heard the slang that it is going to war under a black flag.
Yes, she said. Joe's tried to explain that to me. I try to correct him when he calls that self the killer. He pretends he doesn't hear me.
He hears you, said Rudy. We've talked about it in therapy.
Junie thought about that, then nodded. So what are you trying to tell me? That the killer has gotten off the chain? That it's become his dominant personality?
Junie, please, said Rudy. Let's be clear. Joe does not suffer from multiple personality disorder, not in any clinical sense of that diagnosis. His blend of shadow selves is unique in my experience. Joe perpetuates the three personality verbiage, but they are really aspects of a central personality that is in great turmoil. He is plagued by self-doubts when he is not on the job and is almost inflexible when in combat. His inner certainty of right and wrong is uniquely structured, and it gives him one particular skill set that makes every other quality he possesses function with an unnatural efficiency.
You're talking about his lack of hesitation? Isn't that one of the reasons Mr. Church hired him?
Yes. It's more than merely being quick-brained and having superb reflexes. Joe does not hesitate at all in combat.
He's like that a lot, said Junie wistfully. Ever gone shopping with him? He doesn't browse. He goes right for what he wants. And if you offer him a choice, like when we were browsing online at that place in Eureka, California, he likes Big Fun Shirt Company. He'll go through their catalog and then straight to checkout. No thinking about it, no waffling.
Yes, I suppose he does that.
He's only slow and picky when buying beer. He'll spend an hour in the cold aisle at Vaughn's or Trader Joe's. She cocked her head to one side. But this is off point. Where are you going with all this? Has the warrior or killer or whatever taken over?
If it had, said Rudy, I'd be able to sleep at night.
Oh my God, what are you saying?
When his family was killed on Christmas Eve, when you were so badly injured and nearly died, I believe we witnessed the birth of a new shadow self, a true shadow. Not a personality with dimension, possibly not even with morals or a mission beyond revenge. Juni, he calls it the darkness. And it is so large, so powerful, so potentially dangerous to him that he begged me to find a way to get rid of it for him.
Can you?
Rudy shook his head. I don't even know. We talked about it during his convalescence, and because he was unable to access this new shadow self in any meaningful way that would allow him to evaluate it or even properly describe it, we made very little headway.
What do you know about it?
Rudy paused for a long time, clearly weighing his words with care. It is very dangerous, Juni. To Joe and to anyone, and I do mean anyone, who might get between Joe and his goal of finding and killing Rafael Santoro and Kuga.
And you let him go into the field? Roared Juni.
No, no, please, pleaded Rudy, holding his hands up, palms out. I did everything I could to stop him. I spoke to Jane Holliday, Scott Wilson, and Church, and—
And they all agreed?
No, said Rudy quickly. Jane and Scott were totally opposed to the idea of Joe returning to active duty, not merely in the short term, but ever.
Juni stared at him, her fists clenching so tightly that her knuckles ached.
Church, let him go?
Yes, said Rudy.
Why?
I've asked him that question 100 times, and I always get the same answer.
Which is what?
He tells me that this is war, and that's all he'll say.
Chapter 54. Hotel Eden, Rome, Italy. The burly fellow with the bushy mustache never saw the other man come out of the stairwell. He did not hear him come up behind him. He was entirely unaware of the man's presence until he felt the cold steel of a gun barrel press against the nape of his neck.
Easy does it, Luigi, said the man.
Who?
An old friend. Here, let me have that key card. Jolly good.
The man with the gun swiped the card, turned the handle with his free hand, and then nudged the door open with the toe of his shoe.
Inside. There you go. And don't try any of your stunts on me, Luigi. You didn't take enough karate to help last time either.
Luigi stepped inside, frowning, trying to connect the voice to a face, a name. Face the wall, said the man with the gun as he closed the door.
I'm going to pat you down. You know how this works. Good. Spread your feet wider. Brilliant.
The pat-down was quick but thorough, and it was very professional. The gunman removed a small Beretta from a belt clip and a switchblade from a pocket. Then he stepped back.
You can turn around now, son, said the gunman.
Luigi turned, and when he saw who it was, he gave a small, sharp cry, a yip, like a kicked poodle. He gaped, sputtered, stammered, and finally choked out a name.
Toys? Surprise, surprise, old chum.
Toys held his little automatic with the comfort of a professional, keeping it low and out of reach, the barrel pointed center mass.
What the hell are you doing here? Demanded Luigi. I thought you were dead. I get that a lot, said Toys. But no, still a bad penny. What is this? Why come after me with a gun? What have I ever done to you? Are you an assassin now? Is that it? Oh, settle down, Luigi.
Toys said, stepping back and waving the man toward a pair of comfortable chairs by the window.
If I'd wanted you dead, you'd be on your way to the morgue right now. Now sit down and stop pissing your pants.
Luigi sat. Toys pulled the other chair to a safe distance and lowered himself into it.
I need information, he said.
I don't do that anymore, said Luigi quickly. I'm out of that business, I swear.
Toys crossed his legs and rested the hand holding the pistol on his thigh.
I have a sound suppressor in my pocket, he said.
Shall I screw it in place and see how many kneecaps I need to blow off before you stop telling lies? No, no. Then let's try this again. I need information. You have information, because you always have information. You know more out of the game than I am.
Luigi licked his lips and clutched the arms of the chair with nervous fingers.
What kind of information?
Ah, there we go,
said Toys, smiling.
I'm looking for a few people. Now, you're going to want to take the piss and pretend you've never heard of them. I understand why. They're scary people, and if they ever found out you were telling me anything, they would do very bad things to you. Very bad indeed. You're already starting to sweat. You never did have the stomach for this. God only knows how you got into the information trade.
Luigi stared at him.
I will say three names, continued Toys. You can give me a price for information. I'm willing to negotiate, and if things go well, there's a bonus on top of it. But if you lie to me, or if you tell anyone I was here, well, really, do I need to be explicit with what those consequences might be?
No,
whispered Luigi. Sweat really was bursting from his pores and running down his cheeks.
Here are the names, said Toys. Try not to shit your pants. Neither of us needs that.
Luigi wiped sweat from his eyes.
Cougar, otherwise known as Harcourt Bolton Sr.
Luigi stiffened as if 10,000 volts shot through him.
Raphael Santoro.
Tears broke from Luigi's eyes.
Joe Ledger.
Luigi put his face in his hands.
Good, said Toys. Clearly you know them. Now, let's have a nice little chat.
Chapter 55. Phoenix House, Amphori Island, Greece. Bug popped the top on his sixth Red Bull, tilted back, and drank a third of the can. The first five had just about helped him reboot his brain and get his mental circuits back online. Maybe the sixth would ignite some optimism, though he rather doubted it. This was day 34 of what he thought of as the Big Silence. He did not like to use the nickname Doc Holliday hung on it, Days of Darkness. That made him too sad and too stressed. It had been 34 days since Joe Ledger walked away from the slaughter on the small Croatian island. 34 very long days. His absence and the events precipitating it had spread a cloud of gloom over the entire organization. People spoke more quietly, sometimes in actual hushed voices. There was a pervasive sense of sadness and of dread. Not specifically for the actual life of RTI's legendary senior field team leader, but because if the war could damage Ledger that badly, then who was really safe? This was an extreme form of post-traumatic stress that now seemed inevitable for all of them. The effect was evident in the lack of laughter in the mess halls, the drop in combat range scores, the overall sense of hesitancy that hadn't been there before. And it didn't help any that Top and Bunny were away on some secret mission. Only Church seemed unmoved, though Bug doubted the boss's famous calm was genuine. Bug had been with Church longer than anyone in Rogue Team. Only Aunt Sally knew him better, and she was retired, still going through extensive physical and occupational therapy at an ultra-high-end facility on Corfu, next to where Rudy Sanchez lived with his wife, Circe O'Tree, and their son. There were plenty of people who loved Joe, too. Maybe not Circe, who still held him and her father responsible for the harm that had come to Rudy. Her husband had lost an eye and a knee because of his involvement with the old Department of Military Sciences, injuries he would not have sustained had he not followed Joe into the group or let himself hook his star to Church's never-ending war. It was sad and disturbing. Joe had Junie, who had also been injured badly because of her association with him. An assassin's bullet had destroyed her uterus during the Code Zero case, and she'd been impaled by flying debris when Raphael Santoro blew up the Ledger farmhouse.
She still loved Joe with an intensity that often made Bug want to cry. He'd never been loved that much by a woman. Well, except his mom, but she was another casualty of the war, murdered by Sebastian Galt for the crime of being blood kin to a person working for church.
"Ashes, ashes, we all fall down," he murmured.
Bug was alone in his office, which was a very messy anteroom to the spotless clean room in which the mind reader mainframe and supercomputers hummed relentlessly. Bug swiveled around and looked at two figures inside the room, both of them in protective white garments and safety goggles. One was the slightly hunched and emaciated figure of Yoda, his number two. The other was a woman he'd met in South Korea, a top-of-the-line super hacker named Annie Han. Originally an operative in the NIS, National Intelligence Agency's Computer Counter-Espionage or Cybersecurity Divisions. That was a front, though, a functional cover for her real job, which was that of cyber warfare expert for Arclight, the militant arm of the Mothers of the Fallen. A group of intensely fierce women who waged a private war against human trafficking, sex slavery, and other crimes against women and children. Now, Annie was a member of RTI and of Bug's team. She was also his girlfriend. Not quite a lover in the truest sense of that word, though she was that in a deliciously physical way, but although Bug had fallen pretty heavily for Annie, she was more reserved and guarded with her emotions. The result, she said, of a string of truly disastrous relationships that ended very badly. Bug had hopes, though. He hadn't had a real girlfriend in years. He knew that everyone he worked with thought he was a sexless worker bee who was secretly in love with Mind Reader, and Bug had encouraged that viewpoint because sharing his sadness and loneliness with his friends never felt right. Just the thought of it made him feel like a bit of a freak. He was very much in love now, though. But if Annie was going to fall in love with him, then she was playing a very subtle, long game. She and Yoda were in the middle of a very finicky process of stripping the Calpurnia AI system out of Mind Reader Q1 so that a much more efficient and intuitive system could be uploaded. It was painstaking work, requiring long days, and Annie so often said how tired she was when she headed to her apartment. No accompanying invitation. Bug sipped more of the Red Bull as data flowed across his screen. He did not hear the office door open. He heard no footfalls. "Bug," said Mr. Church. Bug jumped halfway out of his chair, spilling the energy drink down the front of his University of Wakanda t-shirt. "Jesus, H.T. Mortimer Christ!" Bug coughed, grabbing for tissues to dab his shirt. Church made no apology. He never did. Instead, he went around and sat down on an empty chair. He waited while Bug sopped up the spill, tossed the tissues away, and grabbed another can of Red Bull. "Tell me where we are," said Church, "but before you answer, lock the room." Bug tapped some keys to send a security command to his system, locking his office and engaging anti-intrusion devices built into the walls. He trusted everyone at Phoenix House, but when it came to conversations like this, Bug tended to err on the side of caution. "Okay," he said. "Where are we?" "Nowhere, really. Joe killed his RFID chip, which means we can't track him, and let's face it, he knows a lot of ways to get lost." "Give me more than what I already know." "Okay," said Bug. "After Joe abandoned the cigarette boat in Giovinazzo, Scott thinks he went to ground somewhere in Italy. And he supports that because of the hit the other day at Civitella in Valdichiana, Tuscany."
"And you don't buy that?" asked Church. "Even though there was an eyewitness who said they saw a tall man with a white dog near that location?"
"Yes and no. I mean, sure, I think Joe hit that place, and we can tie Alexander Fong to the Cougar group, but I think that was something Joe did when he got back to Italy."
"Explain."
Bug gave Church details about the hit on Vanderweever Biomedical Associates in Johannesburg, South Africa.
"That's another place that has ties to Cougar. Now, before you tell me that a lot of independent labs have ties to Cougar through X number of removes, let me explain. Dr. Gerald Engelbrecht ran that lab, and he, more so than the rest of the staff, has,
or rather had, a bunch of skeletons in his closet. He farmed out a lot of product manufacturing to sweatshops all through Malaysia and Java and a few other places. One standout is that sports equipment factory where there was that riot just recently. And by riot, I mean the highly suspicious one where there was zero cell phone footage or at-the-moment news coverage. Engelbrecht had contracts with them for what the computer records call orthopedic overgarments. No idea what that is, but I'm looking into it.
Now, isn't that interesting?
I think so.
And you think Ledger hit Engelbrecht in Johannesburg?
I do. And then he went back to Italy and took out Alexander Fong and his team. Left Fong alive, though, not sure why. Killed just about everyone and everything else, up to and including the ficus trees in the damned lobby.
You believe this despite Scott Wilson being completely convinced that Ledger was holed up in Italy, perhaps gathering intel before finally making Fong his first move?
I'd bet a lot on it.
So would I, said Church.
Then we come to something I haven't shared with Scott yet. I haven't told anyone about it at all, not even you, because I wanted to dig around a little and make some educated guesses.
Tell me now, said Church mildly.
So, I got a heavily encrypted email from our old friend Oscar Freund.
Captain Freund was the son of one of Church's old friends from the pre-DMS days. Freund worked for the GSG-9 der Bundespolizei, a very effective police tactical unit of the German Federal Police. Officially, GSG-9 is only deployed for hostage situations, kidnapping, terrorism, and similar threats. However, there was a more elite and much more covert counterterrorism strike force within the group that had a much more flexible charter than the public thought. Freund was an investigator for them and one who was at the top of the game. He was also an ally of Mr. Church, another friend in the industry. Oh, said Church mildly.
Oscar received a package delivered by courier. The contents slip said Kontenbuch, which translates as
accounts ledger, finished Church, leaning a bit on the second word. Very interesting indeed. What was in it?
6 4-terabyte external hard drives, the kind that can be bought at any electronics store in any of the bigger cities in South Africa. There was a post-it note on top. Let me pull it up. You'll like this.
Bug hit some keys and a JPEG filled the screen, showing a cell phone photo of the note. There were 2 simple line drawings, one of a church steeple and the other of a 6-legged insect. The words, "to share," written in ballpoint and clearly using a ruler to prevent any chance of handwriting analysis. Bug grinned.
A church and a bug.
Eloquent, murmured Church. What's on the drives?
A lot. Looks like Ledger prepped it for us. There's one drive that has logistics, employee lists, and other stuff that I think he intended for Scott. There's one with a crap ton of encrypted computer files, and I have Nikki Bloom working on it now. The rest are more of the biomechanical stuff and copies of records that I'm now positive are copies of stuff Artemisia Bliss stole from the Jacobis and the Kings. But there's some CIA stuff, too, and a bunch of DARPA research, mostly on military exoskeletons and neural chips for soldier equipment interfaces.
Who else knows about this?
Well, like I said, I have Yoda and Nikki on the encrypted files, but that's it. I wanted to talk with you first because, unless I'm reading this all wrong, you seem to be coy about who and what you're saying about Ledger since he's gone off the radar.
Yes, said Church. He sat there drawing slow circles on the desktop with his left index finger. Don't misunderstand me about this, Bug, he said after a while. There is no mistrust with anyone here at the RTI. No one is under suspicion, and they all have my highest confidence in all critical matters.
You have butt face.
Consider rephrasing that for future use, said Church. But I know how much resentment there is among some of the staff about my letting Ledger back into the field at all.
Yeah, Junie tells me you're dodging her calls, he sighed.
I am. And I've shut down discussions with Scott, Top, and some others because I don't care to explain my motivations.
Rudy has already read me the comprehensive riot act for endangering Joe's mental and physical health, and he's not wrong. I am doing exactly that, but not from a lack of compassion.
No, said Bug. I get it. Even though we're not really answerable to the UN or any world government, ever since Oslo, we're pretty high profile. They're expecting us to be the White Knights here. We can't put a foot wrong because that ruins our credibility with governments from whom we'll need to get permissions to operate within their borders. If they know that we let Joe Bug-Fuck-Nuts Ledger off the leash deliberately, every door will be shut and we won't get stuff like this. He pointed to the screen.
Church smiled faintly. You understand me very well, Bug.
We've been family a long time.
We have. They sat in silence for a few moments. Church reached over and picked up a can of Red Bull, read the ingredients, and put it back. Share the data, he said. Tell Doc and Scott that it came from me via one of my contacts. They'll know not to ask. Make sure Yoda and Nikki get the same story.
Will do.
Church lingered. What's your theory on this?
Well, I'm still leaning toward this being Kuga and Santoro giving their fixers a serious tech upgrade. Those cats with bleeding-edge cybernetics and exoskeletons? And maybe some drug therapy to get them all juiced? Shit, boss. I think we're in real trouble here.
Church stood. I think we've been in real trouble for some time and are only now beginning to see the shape and scope of it. He gave Bug's shoulder a squeeze and went out. Chapter 56. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Top and Bunny were taken to a commercial airport in Texas where John Saxon greeted them with travel documents and first-class seats for a direct flight to Washington State.
If we're going to Washington, why'd we need our passports? Asked Bunny.
Saxon smiled. You're going to Washington today. Other trips are possible, and we don't want to waste time fussing over papers. Top nodded.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
You coming with us? Asked Bunny.
Nah, I don't think you fellows need me to hold your hands. He shook their hands, grinned, waved, and walked away out of the terminal building.
Okay, then, said Bunny.
40 minutes later, they were in the air. They had no idea if anyone else on the flight was a spook for Blue Diamond, so the two of them kept their conversation to ordinary stuff. They talked sports and old movies, but mostly they slept, conserving energy the way professionals in their line of work do. They had one beer each, but nursed them. In Spokane, they were met at baggage claim by a 30-something man in a crisp white shirt buttoned to the throat and blue jeans with severely ironed creases. He held a sign that showed only the Blue Diamond logo. You gentlemen should hit the head because it'll be a long drive, he said. That was his only comment from the moment they met him until he dropped them off at a checkpoint in the middle of nowhere deep in Stevens County. The checkpoint was manned by two men dressed in military-style forest pattern camo uniforms. The drive had taken more than 3 hours, and from the route it was clear the driver was deliberately changing roads and even backtracking, wary of surveillance. At the gate, both guards wore masks that covered their features and carried 6-hour MCX Rattler assault weapons. The gate was set in a forest clearing and was the only part of the fence that was easily visible. From what they could see, the fence was high and wrapped in razor wire. A road led from the checkpoint, and it curved out of sight within a dozen yards. No other buildings were visible from where they stood. Top and Bunny were asked to get out of the car, show their IDs, and to log into a terminal using thumbprints and retina scans. This didn't bother either of them because Bug and Mind Reader had long since gamed the system. Their false identities were unbreakable, and all traces of who they had been were long since erased entirely from hospital, school, military, and other databases. The tapeworm search and destroy programs, Bug wrote, were hungry and thorough. However, Top acted as if he didn't understand how the thumbprint scanner worked. He kept putting the wrong finger on the pad or missed the pad entirely.